This is Kate Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded November 15th, 2012. Tonight we are talking to Ward Bell, who is the VP of Technology at IdeaBlade. And hello, Ward. You've been on before, right?
I was on a long time ago with Jeremy Miller, where we were talking about Entity Framework version 1.
It was, yeah. That was fun. No, it wasn't Entity Framework. We were talking about MVVM, weren't we? Yes, yes.
Really? I thought it was like ORMs. It was back in the day when there was all that contention.
Quite a bit was covered. It's all a blur. Mistakes were made. So so tonight we're talking to you about, originally I contacted you because of Breeze.js, but then as we were talking, it kind of solves a bigger problem that you've been focusing on longer term, right?
Yeah, it addresses it in a specific space. IdeaBlade, my gang, you know, at IdeaBlade, we started back in the beginning of .NET in the early 2000s with the goal of trying to get at rich clients, you know, over the web. So we did a lot of stuff in the .NET space, and as the .NET client technologies kept evolving, we followed along. So we still have, and we're proud of it, our DevForce product, which does client-side data over the wire for Windows Forms, WPF, Silverlight, now Windows 8, what do they call it now? Windows Apps, Modern Apps, I don't know.
Synostified apps.
Yeah. Windows Store applications for modern Windows
I feel
users?
So modern now. Although
something or other.
Go ahead. I thought that term went out in the '50s or something. But anyway, we've been doing all that stuff and still feel good about it. But as you all know, there's been this move towards trying to do similar kind of, well, what would be desktop user experiences, but written in HTML and JavaScript and run in the browser, which is pretty much what I think is what a spa is about. So we started the Breeze project, which, unlike DevForce, is open source and free.
So, you know, you brought that up as that this is what a spa is about. I mean, is there a discussion about you hear people talk about it and everyone's kind of like, okay, I kind of know what it is. And it's like Gmail or it's like, you know, and you can talk about these applications. But you've done some talks recently where you kind of drill into, here's what I think a spa, like more of a, not really a formal definition, but talking about the value proposition.
It's an unfortunate term, as we all know, because it describes the technology and not its purpose. And it describes an attribute of the technology. You know, I think I said somewhere that it's like talking about a horseless carriage, because that's what people noticed about automobiles. So they said, hey, you know, it's something without a horse. And so the thing they notice is, hey, it's just a single web page coming over the wire and everything happens within that shell of a. But it what's interesting about it is what's happening, you know, within that shell and why you do it. And basically, the idea is that you're trying to stay on the client and executing in the client as much as possible, going back to a server when you have to. And the point of it is to have a really rich experience and not rely on a remote server to deliver the experience. And where that really shows up is, like you say, like, when do you need it? It's when you're, one way of saying it is that when you're pivoting around data, you got this sort of collection of data that the user wants to see, and you're not going to present it in a dashboard. I mean, they need the whole screen to work around it, whatever that screen is, whether it's a browser screen or a mobile screen.
You know, that's a key thing that you mentioned there was pivoting around data, because I failed at describing this to someone recently, and I was saying, well, you know, it's like it's HTML, and then JavaScript is calling back into services, and they're like, well, what's the point? And I was saying, well, it's more efficient because you're just passing little bits of data back and forth, and the page isn't reloading. But if all you're doing is just every time you do anything, you're calling a service, then that misses out on some of the value, which you're saying is if you've got data in the client, doing things in the client, right?
It's data on the client, doing things in the client, keeping state about the client so that the client feels like it's happening right there in their box. And that becomes even more important in mobile scenarios where it can be iffy getting back to the server anyway.
Okay.
So yeah, and an awful lot of business line of business or just business applications have always been that way. And one of the questions I like to ask people to ponder is, particularly those who think thin client, thin client, thin client, do everything on the server is, we've had more than a decade of a chance to try and do everything that way. Why is it that there's this large category of applications that continues to be written as desktop apps delivered and executed on the client? There must be something about those things that and what they need to do that resists being transferred to the web, because if you were going to do it, Lord knows there's been enough motivation to do it. But I don't know how the rest of you guys feel about that. But it's an important question for anybody who's trying to figure out whether Spa has legs.
Well, I mean, what are some of the, I mean, some of it's the development pattern experiences. I mean, some of it also seems to be maybe, people are, I don't know, that the tooling is more difficult or worrying about, code running in more than one place. Like they'd write to just, they'd prefer to write one app that has everything local. I mean, what do you think
But
are
you could
some?
do that on the server, right? There's no nothing blocking you from doing a traditional web form or MVC app. And I think of MVC as traditional. That tells you where my head is. From that perspective, you've got all the technology, you've got everything in one place, you've got line of sight with the database from the server. Why has that not been a successful pattern, the basis for many kinds of applications that businesses run?
I think, part of the resistance to single page applications is that there is a bit of a learning curve. You have to learn how to do things differently. And there are some challenges there that take up time. If you do the traditional style application, you don't have to worry about things like managing the browser history because that's just taken care of for you. But when you're writing a single page application, all of a sudden you have to figure out how you're going to prevent the back button from taking someone completely out of the application, right?
Absolutely. Writing spas is not been something that people could do very efficiently or very productively or with any safety. What I was kind of posing the question is what the appeal of a spa, even, I mean, there's always the question like, could you do it? But if you held aside, could you do it? What's the impulse? What's the driver for it? And it's the same impulse that has kept people writing things in WPF and Silverlight. They felt that they needed to get the execution on the client. They couldn't rely on a server to produce the entire user experience. So that's the contrast I was drawing.
Right.
Now, Kevin, you're doing spa type stuff, right?
It's not really a spa. I mean, I'm doing backbone stuff and doing a bunch of client side stuff, but I'm not doing a true single page application, mostly because there just isn't a lot of value. I don't get a lot out of doing that. But then when you're on a particular page, my site does a lot of heavy client side stuff. I think, there's kind of a couple issues around spas. I mean, one is the sort of rich client side interactivity piece of it, and the other is the literal single pagedness of it. That is, you can transition from page to page in a traditional way, and on each page be, very rich client side interactive. Like when do you see that one being appropriate versus the other? You know what I'm saying?
I think I do. I think what you're suggesting is that there are even in what I would have called a more traditional mode, while on the page it can be really rich, and then when I go to another page, I could go back to the server, have it prepare the next page, and have a new environment, and then start there. That's one approach, right?
Right.
And that those of us who are talking about spa don't mean that. And so if you insist, so what's wrong with that? And I think my answer is there's nothing wrong with that. And there's even nothing wrong. I don't think there's anything that says that an entire application has to be a spa. It seems to me perfectly reasonable to have a what the user thinks of as a continuous application which has multiple pages, but they come to a part where they live. I think that though that what happens when it's a spa is that there is a complete screen transition, like what the user sees completely changes several times, and they're moving around, as often pivoting around the data, as I said, without actually making a trip back. And so that's where it breaks away, and there's the value of that arises when you don't want to pay the price of going back to the server in order to completely change the screen. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If you go back, in other words, if you go back to the server to and you're making a module change, for example, so I'm like, I'm done with whatever was on that screen, and now I'm in a totally new universe over here. Well, then you might as well go back. But what often happens in payroll apps and ERP apps and things like that is that there's a sort of starter set that somebody gets involved in, and then they're, you know, doing a little stuff with the customer, then they'll back off and looking at the order, but they're sort of keeping a subset of the data in front of them and making changes to it or looking at it from different angles with that require the entire screen. And they don't, and then they want to go forward a little bit, and then they want to go back, and they don't want to lose context. So it's keeping that context that's so important, even as the entire screen changes. That's hard to do in a traditional style application. At least it's always seemed that way to me. I mean, I don't know, maybe you guys think that it's easy, but it doesn't seem to me to be what the traditional app looks like.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, I'll see pages that do, as long as they're staying in the same context and just loading or changing or filtering data, then they're happy to be like a tiny little bit of a spa. But as soon as it's like, oh, you want a different look at this, or you want to drill down into this, well, that's a postback, you know. So I think you're talking about actually doing, you know, taking it further.
Right. And you see this in mail programs, like a dashboard. Fine. You can just use Ajax to paint the little corridors of the screen that you've done. You know, you're refreshing. But, you know, if you were trying to do a word processor, or you were trying to do a mail program, or you're trying to do an ERP program, you're really talking about moving the whole screen around. You're occupying the user's entire consciousness. And this becomes particularly relevant when one is, you know, as the form factor shrinks. So as you get down to, say, a phone or something like that, where there isn't a whole lot of real estate to deal with in the first place, now you got real questions. And then if we were to look at the people who are trying to program in Windows, God, I have to say this right, window, like on a Surface or something like that, and they wanted to do that in HTML and JavaScript, hey, that's a spa. I mean, it's just architected to be a spa.
So there's two things that I was kind of wondering about. The first is, when you're dealing with a spa, do you still do some, what would you say, preloading of data? Or do you literally just send down the templates and the view logic, let's say, to be able to go back to the server and get everything you need to put the data in? A lot of times when we've done, haven't really done any pure spa apps, but I've done, you know, ones where we've had a lot of a heavy client side interaction, and we've usually preloaded like the starting data that the user is going to need, so that when we're going back to the server, whether it's Ajax or going to another page, we're sending small updates rather than getting large amounts of stuff back.
That's a very typical spa strategy. And you can also, and because you can, you know, you're going to be there for a while, you can afford to start anticipating the data that you want and load that in background, because you have this feeling you're going to go somewhere and it'll be there. So there's a fair amount of that going on. You might, for example, load the screen of customer information as a list. Meanwhile, you know they're going to drill in or something like that. So in background, you anticipate what they're doing and get the rest of it.
And my second one is kind of related to that, but it has to do with loading the data as well. And I was wondering how many spas that you've seen, or that anyone else here has written, have started to make use of the offline manifest abilities in HTML5, or if these single page apps are still intended to be connected 100% of the time, or if you kind of do a split where, yeah, sometimes we'll sync the data locally, sometimes we'll point to static resources to be cached offline to speed up the overall page loading, even if you're going from view to view.
Yeah, the support for everybody wants to do what you're describing in terms of being able to have set manifest and keep data locally and even run for extended periods offline. You know, bringing that off in practice is the support for that, and the experience necessary to do it is there isn't a lot of that. And I'd have to say I haven't done very much of it, just experiments. And but it seems like that's where it's pointing.
There was a I don't know if it was famous, but there was a quote by a guy named Brett Simmons. Brett Simmons, who did the first big RSS reader for Mac, and it was an excellent reader. But he said basically, sync is hard, and I think that's really the hardest thing you're going to run into when trying to do an offline web app is, okay, so the user's made all these changes, and how are you going to get them back and reconcile them with any other changes that have been made on the server or by other users, and et cetera. And that's really not specific to apps. That's just the hardest part of being offline.
Right. Yeah. And we've dealt with that one over the last 10 years because we had the same capability in the .NET side of the house when we were doing this. And you're right, it is challenging. And there are certain strategies that you apply. For example, sandboxing sessions, you know, like suppose I'm working on one order, right, and I got it in flight and I can't save it. So I bundle that up as one thing and I store that locally and then I move on to the next order. And you sort of indicate through the UI that it didn't really happen yet, but it's there. And then when you get the connection, you pretend like they were online all the time and you play it and you hope to survive concurrency errors. But the longer you're offline, the greater the chance that something's going to be wildly out of sync. That's one reason I'm not a big believer in automated background syncing, because when things go wrong, you got to bring the human back in, usually.
You know, I'm wondering if libraries like SignalR and more of the WebSockets realm are going to make that a little bit, not necessarily easier, but a little bit more possible. In that, you know, at least if someone is editing the same record as you, like both ends to the client side will know about it. Hey, so-and-so is also working on this. Or so without having to do the giant lock that whole, you know, row and anything associated with it, anything related to it in the D, you know, just keep polling and say, hey, I'm still editing this row. I'm still editing this row. If there are any changes, let me know. Hey, this, you know, highlight it in the UI real time through SignalR or some other kind of long polling mechanism to say, hey, this row has been modified since you last opened it. Do you want to refresh?
Yeah, I think SignalR is really going to improve that story. I don't see it so much in all the time in the one that you're describing where there's contention so much as it's, I really need to know that truck moved from point A to point B when it happens, or that this order came in or whatever. Because if two people start working on the same thing, then the fact that you know about it is... you're gonna then have to do something about it, and the strategies for that I've seen that we've used most effectively are more like you take out a lease, you do a soft lock, you can't do hard locks. But you know, if I know I'm working on this order, I register in the database a lease on it for a period of time, and then I can renew that, and somebody else will know, the application will know not to go into it. So that kind of stuff is more traditional, but where SignalR really is going to be great is dealing with that question, you know, how do I know when something happened back there that I need to know about now?
Okay, so we've talked kind of generally about, you know, single page applications. Obviously, you've been working on a solution for that. So there are a lot of different, you know, JavaScript libraries out there on the client. There's JavaScript technologies, and then server side, you can build services. What can something like Breeze do to make it better than that? What other problems can you solve?
Right. So, well, one of the things that we try not to do is boil the ocean. There's lots of parts to making a SPA. So there's the screen navigation, there's binding frameworks, you know, there's routing and DI and all those kinds of things that you really need to do. And we're just pretty much focused on the data problem, and in particular, how you cope with data that are relational, whether they're stored in a relational database or not. But, you know, there are these object refs. How do you get them? How do you maintain them? How do you share them from screen to screen? How do you do change tracking? How do you percolate validation rules down from the server side that validation rules that make sense to be on the client? That kind of thing. That's the focus the Breeze has, because that's kind of what we're used to developing all these years. And we looked around in that space, and there aren't a lot of players in that particular slot in the SPA architecture stack.
So, you know, this will remind the astute listener of, you know, previous effort here. There was the previous Microsoft single page application template, and it had Upshot and some other things, and then was removed. And then now the new template doesn't have that Upshot stuff and is a lot more lightweight. what have you kind of seen going on with all that?
Yeah. Upshot was going after this problem, and I think a lot of people were counting on it. And then it just disappeared. And by the way, we should be pretty clear about that, because there seems to be some confusion about whether Upshot really went away and is gone for good, or whether it's just on the shelf. And from what I can see, it's... I think we can safely say it's gone, and it isn't coming back.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the official thing, we were talking about this the other day, and from the roadmap, it says, because I wanted to get the wording right and not like, you know, because I have to be careful what I say as a Microsoft guy, but it was kind of like along the lines of, we had this, we are not we're not currently working on it, and we want to focus on improving development experience for other popular things, and we'll revisit in the future, you know, to see if we need to do more here.
So, of course, they're going to release it as open source along with the ASP.NET web stack, right?
Yeah,
right?
That is interesting, right? I guess because that was before it was all open source. So, honestly, I don't know.
And maybe the recipes, too, for MVC, right?
You know, you're breaking up on the call here. yeah, no, those are all good questions, and I ask about that stuff occasionally, too.
Well, let's see, John, since you're the designated Microsoft employee here.
Well, you can still get the Upshot bits, okay? But they go to nowhere, and they interact with back-end software that doesn't exist anymore, and nobody's going to put any energy into them.
And that's a key thing, right? Because Upshot is a cool JavaScript library, and JavaScript, regardless of if it's open source, is always kind of floating around out there anyhow. But the key thing that Upshot did was it had this client and server side, right? Because there was this... you know, JavaScript side, but then it talked to a special data controller that handled all the synchronizing and transactions and stuff like that.
It grew out of the RIA services world, and so it was particularly targeted towards talking to RIA service controllers in the beginning anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some of these encumbrances led people to find it, what's the official word, too prescriptive or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the feel that I get from this new template. Is it's a lot more like, hey, we've got web API and we've got Knockout, and you bring whatever else you want.
Right. So we at Breeze were determined not to get caught in the Upshot lock-in problem. They also suffered from being pulled in six or seven different directions by different forces within Microsoft before they had to give up. But we said, look, this is a JavaScript library trying to make it possible for JavaScript clients to succeed in managing object graphs on the client. But what we said also was, we're not going to lock into any particular backend server, and we're not even going to lock into any particular binding library. So for example, Breeze works with Knockout, but it also works with Backbone. Thank you, Kevin, for the Stickit, for telling me about Stickit, which without which I don't know how you'd successfully do two-way data binding in Backbone. But that was a big help. And we're going to have a library for Angular, and people could write their own for CanJS or whatever. So there were these different dimensions on which we said, no, don't get locked in. Solve the problem and then open it to other people's choices about, say, what modeling library you wanted. And similarly, on the back end, you know, there's just more ways people can send data to you than you could imagine. There are crazy APIs out there. So we have to be ready to cope with that. On the other hand, people really want a glide path, something smooth that takes you from one end to the other. And especially if you're coming out of the .NET land, which we do. We wanted to make that easy. And I think the SPA template is attempting to make that easy without locking you in, the one that's being proposed. And that's certainly been our approach. So we have a real easy path. If you like Entity Framework and you like the web API and you like Knockout, then you can be up and running with a NuGet package in about 2 minutes.
So trying to put this all in context then, the current SPA template that is in the ASP.NET fall update build preview, whatever it is, but basically the ASP.NET fall update is a preview. It's not released yet, but it's very lightweight. Like, you've just got Knockout and it calls into web API, and it doesn't handle a lot of the things you've been talking about, like caching and change tracking and querying and stuff, right?
Nope. The spot template is kind of a noble effort to try and get people reacquainted with spa or acquainted with spa ideas, but it's only one screen, and there's no real spa that is one screen. It's just, it violates the whole idea of spa. And its whole treatment of data is, well, we'll just talk to the web API with Ajax, but, you know, we'll save every time anybody changes any single property. It's a to-do app. So it's hard to say what somebody's going to learn from that template as it's currently constructed.
Wait, is that the to-do app or whatever they call it? Is that the one it's based on?
It is based on a to-do app. It is a to-do app. It's actually very pretty. Mm-hmm.
It looks like Post-it notes.
It does. And you demonstrated it at Build.
Yeah, let me ask you, can you do Post-it notes in Breeze?
No, you really can't. Breeze can't do to-do.
Well, okay. Okay, so obviously we're talking about different screens. So how does Breeze approach this different screen kind of thing?
Well, the thing that happens the minute that you have two screens is you start thinking, I've got to be able to share data across two screens. Presuming that the two screens are in some sense related. And a good way to get a sense of this, get a little shout out here to John Papa's spa course on Pluralsight. And the application, we'll have some links for people that they can actually try, called Code Camper, which has about six screens that all orbit around sessions and speakers and time slots and things like that. Just looking at it from the different perspectives that you would be having if you were trying to work your way around in a conference. And it shows kind of what I mean by, all right, we got all these different screens, but they're all, and each of them has their own view and view model, but they've got to share a common model. And in order to do that, you have to have some kind of a container holding what I'm, you know, a cache holding the things that are being seen on screen so that they can be shared from one view model to another. But they don't have to confront that. You know, when you put out a spa template that only has one screen, you don't have to confront that. You don't have to confront that, the spa template has a to-do list and to-dos, and you navigate from the to-do list to the child to-dos, okay, but what if you were looking at an individual to-do and to go find the list that you belong to? How would you get back? They didn't have to confront any of these issues. They didn't have to confront, they don't confront in the template. If you make a change to a single property, it saves immediately. You don't need change tracking if you do that, but no application I know works that way. So by studiously avoiding through the UI anything that puts pressure on how you're handling data, it can look like you're solving a problem with that template. But I think people are going to run out of road room pretty fast.
Okay, then in solving those more complex problems, you've got a local cache. So how is that specifically handled? Do I have a JavaScript object that holds kind of a bunch of state? And how do I need to flush that up to the server from time to time? Or how is that synced up to the server?
Well, in the primrose path, the great path, you might start at the server and work down. If you had an EF model, say, and you're running through the web API, we could send some metadata down that describe the entities that you're working with, the types that you're working with. And so Breeze can receive those metadata and construct types on the client that match up well with whatever is in that metadata. It can have the same shape. You can send down certain validation rules like required and string length and all that kind of stuff. You can know what the keys are. You can know what the relationships are. So you can navigate from customer to order and order to order detail and order detail the product, that kind of thing. All this information becomes available, and Breeze can construct this stuff on the fly for you so that you don't actually have to try and write JavaScript types on the client and make sure that they align with what's on the server, because we can just do it. Now, sometimes you need to extend, it doesn't look exactly the same, or you need some behaviors on the client, and you can do all that. Hey, it's JavaScript, and we have a way of having you do that. But for the most part, that tedium of trying to align your types across that divide, is we take care of it. And so you just you know, as a developer on the SPA, you just issue a query which looks suspiciously like a link query on the client. And it goes across and it's in an OData-ish syntax and it can have expands in it and stuff like that. So you can do selections and expands and it pulls data back down. We recognize those as the entities that are described in your metadata and construct instances of them in your cache. And we hold them in cache. And by the way, the kind of instance that we create depends on what modeling library you've chosen. So if it's knockout, there, you know, the entities are going to have those instances are going to have knockout observable properties. If it's backbone, then they're going to have backbone style properties. If it's Angular, it's going to fit that way. And you don't have to write DTOs and mappings and all that stuff that people do when you look to see what's happening when people code this stuff by hand. If you look at the SPA template, for example, that we were talking about, it does something like that. It takes the raw JSON objects and pours them into something that's a knockout ready object. We do all that stuff for you, which is just plumbing code, no reason to do yourself. So that's the way it comes down. And then it's bound to the screen and so forth, and changes happen. Those changes are recognized, tracked, because the entities are self-tracking. And then when you say, you know what, I think it's time to save these things, you know, there could be inserts, updates, modifies, deletes, whatever. We can detect which objects of these various types have been modified and send them up as a single transaction to be processed on the server. So we got that loop going. And that's the basic architecture.
So, Ward, one thing that you pointed out to me before is that the controller side is a little different too, because you otherwise end up with, you know, a bunch of separate controllers and a bunch of separate everything. And with Breeze, you have one controller that kind of receives all these changes and figures out what to do with it.
Yeah, let me take another crack at that. If you do when you do standard web API type controllers, controller per type, if you look at them, they tend to be, well, there's a controller for each entity type or whatever it is that you're sending over the wire. And it usually has the insert, update, and delete methods in it, and maybe some special get methods in it. And and it's full of all, if you look at most of the ones that people show you, they're full of all kinds of implementation details that shouldn't be there, I suppose. But they all, you know, they probably have all four of those CRUD methods in them. And then you mint one after another. And you know, if you've got 30 entity model, which isn't a big model, you're going to end up, you know, you could easily end up with 30 controllers to wrestle with. And what we said is, you know, if we only really need one save method, we don't need insert, update, and delete methods for every type. We can get rid of all of that. And then, so basically you're left with, and by the way, if you don't need special little query methods, because we're using OData query syntax to get at customers. So I don't have to have one that says get customer by ID, get customer, all customers, get gold customers. I don't have to have all that variety. I just have to have an iQueryable of customer. If we do that, then it pretty much works out to one method per type that you want to expose over the wire. And if you do that, having a controller with a single, you know, a controller for every type and a single method for in every controller, that kind of doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, it turns out you could do that if you wanted to. Breeze wouldn't care, but you know, most of the controllers we ever show are just like, hey, here's one controller and it's got query methods for all the types you want to expose and a single save method and a single metadata method and you're done.
So basically you implemented iRepository of T in JavaScript.
Yeah. You could think of it that way. So it's very simple for somebody because they're relying on iQueryable to get a lot of the search variety. Although I just want to say you're not locked into this. You can write specialized query methods just fine. It doesn't care. But what happens sometimes is you see this in various architectures is because people want to deal with all the edge cases, they impose a whole lot of cruft and ceremony on everybody to do the simplest things. And so we try and do the simple things as cleanly as possible. And then if you got to do something unusual, have at it.
I'm kind of a big fan of that kind of pattern. And I kind of try to push a little bit farther. Recently at a Cascadia.js conference we had last week, a guy there was talking about doing big data query, and not that every SPA should be doing big data queries, but when you get into big data, you start to move the query from the client to the server. So you end up passing the query off to the server.
And that's one of the things that I always thought was interesting about Mongo and some of the other non-relational document kind of DBs, is that you end up just sending a JavaScript function that it can call via a map function, pass into a map function to get back your stuff. And that's kind of what you do in this iQueryable in your Breeze base controller, I guess we'll say. You'd say, okay, just compose your query here and we'll send it off to the server, and the server now can interpret it and do whatever it wants.
Exactly right. Exactly right. That is precisely the value of it. Rather than having what I think of as server-side method pollution, where everybody's crafting a specially named method that differs only slightly from somebody else's, and then the server-side API grows and grows and grows, and nobody remembers which one is for which, and so they instead of fixing one, they just roll a new API method, and it just gets out of hand. I assume you've all seen that kind of API madness.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and when I look at something and it's too magic, that's worrisome. But then when I look at something that's too verbose and requires a bunch of different methods, and like you're saying, just with a different name and one variable different, or a bunch of controllers and they're all the exact same and they're really pretty much passed through and they're just calling back into a repository to do something, then it's kind of like that's asking for you to just miss one little change that somebody made to one of those controllers, you know, and you've got to, you don't know.
And it also that I think that's also it becomes hard to put your server side. You know, we depend on server side logic for validating things and for guarding the fort. And when you have a giant API with this bristling with all these methods, then it also becomes hard to try and apply consistent validation and sort of fences and security fences across the API when it's got so many entry points.
So I'd like to change gears and talk about, you know, we mentioned a bunch of other JavaScript libraries, and some of these overlap. And so I wanted to kind of talk about a little bit about the landscape of how these fit together. Like you mentioned things like Ember and Angular, and I just wonder if you could kind of compare how these fit together. Like, are they overlapping, or, you know, how do I decide between them, or do I need them both?
Yeah, it's a great question. Like in many spaces, there's sort of two poles. There's the thing where somebody does they want to roll their own stack of technologies, and they want to pick their idea of the best library of the moment for each layer in the stack. And then there's the other pole, which says, I'm going to give you one thing that does it all. And so we have to sort of separate those. They each have their advantages, I suppose. But you mentioned Ember, for example, and I know that Ember aspires to be, it's very ambitious in wanting to be the one stack you need to build a spa. It tries to have an answer for how you'll handle screens, how you'll bind, how you'll do data, how you'll build modules, how you'll build classes. It gives you one stack for all of that. And people love it. The people who love it. And the other people who look at it and they're afraid of it. And that's a tension. And I don't know that there's a right answer, because I think it's partly cultural what you like. But they certainly, within that stack, they have something that's approximately like Breeze, which is they call Ember Data, which fits into their whole Ember universe. Then you have the other end, and we're kind of at the other end in that we just concentrate on the data layer. And you would then, there you have contenders like, do I use Knockout or do I use Backbone for binding and templating? And what am I going to use? You know, maybe I'll use SAMI to do the screen changes. So you then have these parts and pieces stacks. Angular, I think of as being somewhat on the ambitious side of things, but above the data layer. It wants to help you with modular design. It wants to help you with having a two-way data binding structure, screen management on the client, and dependency injection. And that's a lot of the parts of the architecture stack that you would need to build a spa. So that's kind of the way I see it. Kevin, you've been in this space a while. I mean, does this resonate?
I pretty much agree with your assessments. And the obvious sort of counterpoint is Backbone, which doesn't try to be the top to bottom stack.
No, it's
much thinner.
it knows what it wants to be and what it wants to cover and what it wants to leave to you.
Right. And what it doesn't cover is a lot. I mean, there's certainly a lot of stuff that people end up adding on via plugins and stuff to flesh it out a bit. But I think what people like about that is that it isn't as prescriptive. It doesn't like dictate your whole architecture. It's more of the library versus framework approach, you know, or the framework calls you and you call the library kind of distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And one nice thing about Backbone is that it's you can tiptoe into it. You can sort of slowly migrate stuff of your that you have over into Backbone's model, whereas doing something like that with an Angular where it wants to control the top to bottom stack is a little harder.
Yeah, I think they're all fascinating, and they're definitely like ones that are more heavy and prescriptive, like Angular and Ember seem to be. Like anything, there's more investment to figure them out, but then people that are really into them are really into them, you know. But I guess as you're talking through them, you know, in describing Breeze as you know, I mean, it does solve quite a bit on the server and, you know, managing data. And then, you know, you work with whatever binding or stuff on the client. So that really does sound very similar to what was being solved by Upshot. How do you see this as like a direct replacement for that Upshot, you know, that vision? Or
I think they were both going after that problem, that one problem. And I do see, you know, anybody who thought Upshot was addressing a problem that they cared about is going to find that Breeze addresses that same problem. And so they will say, if there isn't going to be an Upshot, I'm glad there's a Breeze.
And then as far as other libraries that are similar, I mean, we talked about Angular doing quite a bit, but I haven't seen that Angular does this kind of there's no real server side piece to Angular.
That's right, and there's no data piece to Angular either. There isn't in Backbone. There is in none of the ones that we've talked about except Ember Data. Is there anything comparable to what Upshot was striving to do or what we were trying to do? What they all do is they say, well, you know, here, use Ajax to go get it. I don't know where you're going to get it from, but give me the data back and pour it into my kind of objects and can you continue on? They don't have any notion of caching or object graph navigation or change tracking or any of that stuff. They don't have it.
I mean, from that perspective, they're kind of more of a pure MVC kind of approach. They're saying, you know, don't do any kind of logic. I just, you give me the data, I create the view, I'm the controller, I add the data to it, and I render it, and that's all I do. But you always need a little bit more than that. And actually, as kind of an aside, what the heck ever happened to Batman.js? Wasn't that a thing?
Yeah, I was wondering about that too.
I almost completely forgot about that. Wasn't that another MVC framework?
Yeah, it was an MVC framework of the week a while back, but it does seem to have kind of disappeared.
Yeah. The thing I want to say is that is a hard enough problem. Some of these are really hard problems. And just getting your model view controller interaction right, that's plenty to bite off and chew, I think.
Yeah, and so talking about these, we've got all these different kind of things that solved some client-side stuff. The only other one that you said is kind of similar is Ember, and then you said that, you know, both Ember and Breeze are kind of you can pick off parts that you want, but in general, the happy path for Ember is a little more focused on Rails for the server. And then what you were saying is that, you know, the happy path with Breeze, it's gonna really work well if you've got Entity Framework and a MVC or a Web API kind of server system. Would you say that's kind of a fair overgeneralization?
I think that's a fair overgeneralization. I just want to clarify one point. The thing that we're comparing here is Ember Data, which is a submodule of Ember. Most of what people, when they talk about Ember, that they like about Ember, they're really talking about, again, MVC and above. You think MVC to organize the view and then all the pieces that you need to knit together different views. Make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Ember Data, which hardly anybody knows, and it isn't even in release, unlike Ember, which is pretty stable, Ember Data is like 0.5 or something like that. But it is the thing that is totally focused on the object graphs, change tracking, and how do I talk to the server, and what servers do I really talk well to problem. In that, it is particularly attuned to the Ruby on Rails community and Active Record and things like that. And although they're very clear that they want to be open to everything, and we do the same thing, right? We say, we don't care what your back end is or what your tradition is or what tools you like. We want to be there for you. But if, you know, it's a happier cultural path if you like to use Visual Studio and you like you like Web API and you like iQueryable and you like OData, you know, all of these are .NET traditions that if you have an affinity for them, you're going to be really comfortable with Breeze.
Okay, so we've talked about a bunch of different things and bunch of different frameworks for solving them. Hopefully, if some people have stayed with us, what is the best way now to because it sounds complicated, but then going through some of your tutorials for Breeze is actually pretty. It's very simple. Like you have some sample projects, and you have.
I thought you were going to say it was a breeze.
I'll fix that in editing.
Edit, fix that in post.
Yeah. So, I mean, is it difficult to get started with Breeze?
Well, you know, I hope not. I mean, we are working so hard on that front. We think that's the most important front to work on because it's easy to get scared in these technologies, right? So, you know, that's why we have a NuGet package that you can just start with an empty MVC project and you go and you're up. And you can come to our site and get documentation, and you can come there and you've tried the live tutorial thing, which
we should definitely talk about that. I mean, that is really slick because you've got this. So off it's breezejs.com, and then off of that there's this tutorials link at the top, and then from that there's all these kind of steps where you page through and it has the JavaScript, the HTML, and you click a button and you hit run and it's interactive and you can see what it's doing really quickly.
Yeah. Knockout did that really great. One of the reasons Knockout has been so successful is because of all the ways it made it easy for people to learn about it. And that was one of the things that they did. And we thought that was great. And it's kind of like if you've ever used JS Fiddle, you're sort of using the JS Fiddle model to play, but it now guides you through them through a progression. So we do that. And then there was a thing I think I was showing to you the other day where we're trying to use unit tests or automated tests, if you will, not unit tests, as a way of teaching how to solve problems with Breeze. And also we hope that encourages people to get comfortable with writing tests for JavaScript because, man, if you're not writing tests for JavaScript, I think you're going to be you're going to be in trouble.
And, you know, when you showed this to me, it reminded me of Ruby cones. And so I remember I was first introduced to those at Seattle Code Camp. The two of us were sitting next to each other going through those. But it's the same kind of approach where they have these failing unit tests and you go through and you solve one and then it shows you the next. It's different implementation that you've got there, but the unit tests do show specific actions and you can look at them and the test shows how things work, right?
Exactly. And you can either lift the code out of the test and say, oh, I see how that works. I want to use that. Or you can say, you know, I want to try this edge case. So I'm just going to tweak it and run it some more and see it fail. But you get ideas because you can't just write text all the time. You have to give people something that they can execute. So that's one of the ways we're trying to get it across, and it can be a few simple concepts. What we struggle with sometimes is we want to tell everybody about all the things you can do at the edges when you get into trouble. And yeah, that stuff's all there. But if you just want to do the straightforward stuff, there should be a few concepts that you need and a few buttons you hit and off you go. And I like to think that we're making that possible.
And as an aside, I don't know if you want to keep this in or put it towards the end or something like that, but along the JavaScript unit testing framework or front, I've been using Jasmine with the Chutzpah runner for Visual Studio. And I've gotten a lot of people who normally would never write tests for JavaScript writing tests in it. And it's nice because it not only runs them inside of Visual Studio, but it can run them on your CI server through a console runner. And you can also just run them in a regular web browser. So if you're looking at, you know, if you don't already have a way kind of doing that, that might be something else to look at. Is look at incorporating Jasmine, because then in your demos, you can also say, hey, you just NuGet install this
Chutzpah or Chutzpah package, and you can run your tests right inside of Visual Studio.
I really like the sound of that. I mean, we, our stuff has been in QUnit, but I've been hankering after getting my hands around Jasmine for a while. I think, Kevin, you use Mocha, right?
Yeah, I use Mocha.
But I want to try some of these others, and that sounds great to be able to do it inside Visual Studio. So I'm going to follow up with you on trying to come up with a couple of those.
They even have support for the Unit Test Explorer in VS 2012, which wow. I was like, hey, okay.
In the interest of comparing lots of different similar things, so we've got Jasmine, QUnit, and Mocha. Does anyone want to explain how those things, how you compare those?
So QUnit is dead simple, just straight unit test. Just the test is a function that takes true or false. Jasmine is a little bit more along the BDD style, where you say it and it should be and things like that, and you kind of nest them together so that the output is a little prettier than just with regular QUnit. And Mocha is, I want to say CoffeeScript, but Kevin can
know. No, more about that. Mocha is not CoffeeScript.
Mocha is completely not CoffeeScript. I apologize to Mocha.
Yes, you should apologize to the author, TJ Hollowaychuk. He's very much not a
fan. Oh, it's TJ. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Mocha is, it's, describe Mocha. It's a test framework that you can sort of put different skins in front of. So if you like sort of XUnit style testing, you can use that approach. If you like, RSpec BDD style, like a la Jasmine.
That's right. It's like the
has sort of pluggable
and give in, that kind of stuff, right?
What's that? Sorry?
You guys are all talking at once.
It supports the given and should and test and all those kinds of asserts. So you write like one kind of spec, but then you can use given, then, when, and whatever else you want to use. I think they were talking about that at Cascadia.
Yeah, they sort of. Yeah, you can use sort of different front ends, whether depending on what you prefer. And you can use different assertion libraries with it. So I use it in sort of BDD mode, where you get describe and it and that sort of Jasmine style stuff, but you can also use it in XUnit mode or unit mode where it's more QUnity, and then it has a runner. The thing that's really nice about Mocha is it has really great handling for async stuff, and Jasmine's handling of async stuff is really terrible, which is the original reason why I switched over to it.
Why I did QUnit, because the QUnit async is easy, and in Jasmine, it just seemed to be hard.
Yeah, it's really, I'm kind of shocked they haven't fixed that, to be honest.
We should tell our listeners that, everybody's been telling everybody they got to have tests like since day one, and I haven't been to a shop yet that uses tests, but when you go into JavaScript, man, you really need them.
Yes.
I think, I don't know what different experience is, but I generally see that's the last place that people start, like people feel more comfortable putting tests in server side code, but I hear fewer people talking about testing JavaScript. I don't know if that's.
I'm with you, and it scares the heck out of me because you don't have a compiler to help you, which of course brings us to TypeScript, right? you guys are, I'm really hopeful about TypeScript. I don't know about you guys.
Heretic.
I think that's a subject for a whole new thing because I don't know. Where are you at, Scott Kuhn? I heard all different kinds of things from you.
I think I've made my position on TypeScript very clear.
So you're a fan?
No.
I saw you had a sticker on your laptop.
With a very carefully placed bang in front of the TypeScript.
All right.
I think JavaScript's got 99 problems, but I don't think typing is one.
All right. I'm
with Scott, by the way.
I would want to dig into this more, but I heard earlier somebody mentioned Mocha and then CoffeeScript, and then I'm thinking about coffee, and I know we need to wrap up soon, but Ward, you were bragging about a fancy new coffee machine you've got there.
Yeah, I got a Rocket, and I could give you the Italian name of it, but I just call it the Rocket, and I'm sitting here drinking a single origin Sumatran tar burrito pea berry that I roasted this morning. So I'm living large here. the Italian name is the Giotto Evoluzione, but Rocket's easy.
Wow. Yeah, and we were comparing notes earlier, and we both get our coffee from the same place, although you get it direct, and I have them ship it to me. Sweet Maria's?
Sweet Maria's. We got to put a link on the show. Great people, great beans. I go right down to their shop in Oakland and get it.
Nice.
I'm figuring you have a nicer roaster than I do. I'm still ghetto style roasting in a stainless steel dog bowl on my barbecue.
See, I think that's so cool. I mean, I have a Baymore, and I used to have a. This is crazy because nobody's gonna know what any of these things are. But a Baymore looks like a toaster oven. But it's really easy. But I think dog bowl on the barbecue is the best.
I don't know if it's good or bad, but I actually got my 11-year-old. She wanted to try it out, so she roasted a batch, and it was pretty good. It looked like it was gonna be burned, but it ended up pretty tasty. So
you're giving your 11-year-old coffee?
No. No, but my kids are very. See, what happened is my 9-year-old asked me to teach her how to run the espresso machine. She said, "I want to make you an espresso." So, oh, sure, you know.
Oh yeah, that's awesome.
But then I didn't realize she would come into my office at like 3:30 in the afternoon and be like, "Hey, are you getting tired? Wouldn't you like an espresso? 25 cents." I'll deliver it. And so I said, yeah, sure. So then she started racking up all this money. So I think the 11-year-old saw that and she's like, hey, you know, she's got that game locked down, but if I can get into roasting, you know, so I don't know.
More money there.
Hey, I tell you what, Skid, Mark, why don't you go clean your room and then you can make me a question,
exactly.
Huh?
Oh, man. Where do we go from there?
I think it's a great place to end up, but did we leave out anything that you guys wanted to touch on? Or
I was going to briefly ask about what dependencies Breeze.js has. I think I remember them. But how did you make the decision to take a dependency on those external libraries, if any? Because I've written some JavaScript libraries before, and I've always tried to toe the line between, okay, so if they don't have jQuery, I have to write all these internal functions, you know, for doing fast things like, you know, map and sorting and blah, blah, blah. But if they do have jQuery, I gotta make it fit in as a plugin and yada, yada. And I'm always conflicted whether I do two different versions or if I just do one that just does all the jQuery detection and makes it work. And I just was curious what you guys decided.
Well, we pretty much got rid of dependencies on all third-party libraries. We don't depend on jQuery anymore. Now you can plug in whatever Ajax solution you want. That was the only thing we were using it for. The only current dependency we have is on a promise library called Q, because you got to do promises in some form or another if you're going to do Ajax. I mean, if you're going to do asynchronous something, rather. And I bet we could get rid of that. Otherwise, you know, we're free of all those dependencies. We do write to ECMAScript 5. So if you're in need a browser that isn't going to do ECMAScript 5, which I hope our audience knows, then you need to add some shims, at the top to help you get around that. But other than that, I think we've successfully gotten rid of all of the dependencies except on Q.
Did you find yourself having to rewrite any kind of functions, like I said, like map or kind of get element or reduce functions, stuff like that?
Well, map and for each come are ECMAScript 5. So we just assume that they're there and that you're going to shim them if you don't have them, right? And because we don't talk to the view, remember, where it's at data, we don't have to deal with, we don't talk to the DOM at all. We have no relationship to the DOM whatsoever.
I guess that makes sense.
But I do know the dilemma that you face and how tough that is. But
So you're not doing any fallback other than, you know, manual. So, hey, if you want to use our library and you're not sure if you're going to be ECMA 5, you better use your own polyfills, you know, where necessary.
Right. And we'll tell them where. We tell them, we say, okay, if you know you got to hit those guys, then you probably need these three library. Well, you need the polyfills, and we can say that these three work. The three being shim, sham, and JSON2, and then you're fine with IE 7 and above. And frankly, if you want to go back before that, I don't know what you're doing right in a spa, because it's not going anywhere anyway.
All right. Well, we need to wrap up. So let's finish up with the Pimp Your Stuff thing. I think we probably should play the Pimp Your Stuff theme music, because you probably are the best dressed pimp I know. For those that are listening and haven't seen Ward at a conference, he wears the most awesome clothes ever.
Well, thank you. I Bootsy Collins is my sartorial guide. I really want to look like I'm ready for the mothership.
All right.
And if time and we can shake it, and I think we can, this next MVP summit or whatever it is, we're going to go to Leroy's Menswear.
Oh, yes. Wow. Yes, I've heard about that place. Can we go as a group? Let's do it.
I don't know. We're mighty white to be going in there, but I think they'll let us in.
You're going to group.
Well, I'm totally serious about it, and so I'm game.
On that note, do you have anything to actually pimp? You've got. I mean, we've been talking about Breeze. Are you speaking anywhere soon? Do you have any other producty stuff you want to sell?
Yes. Actually, I'll be doing something with Patterns and Practices on actually the Windows app side of the fence on XAML and C# stuff. And we're very, the other thing I want to pimp is the DevForce and Cocktail combination that I mentioned at the top of the show, which is really aimed at people who, have the same idea of a rich client, but they want to build in XAML and C#. And Cocktail is this fusion of Caliburn Micro and DevForce, when DevForce is kind of solves the same problem that Breeze does, only for a .NET client. So if you want to go that way, you really need to take a look at that combination.
So just to clarify all these things, so DevForce is a product, and Cocktail is DevForce plus Caliburn Micro. So and Caliburn Micro being, we've had Rob on before, it's this open source, cool MVVM and binding and all kinds of.
Yeah, MVVM with convention over configuration.
Right.
And it has screen stuff too. See, a lot of people get stuck on the MVVM stuff, and that's just how you create the views, but you got to knit these things together and get from one to the other, and he's got great stuff with that. And Cocktail is open source, out there on GitHub for pulling these things together so that you can actually have a prayer of putting an entire application together.
Okay, and then back to Breeze, just real quick. That is MIT. That's all completely free, and the only thing that's the only place where money comes in at all there is that you offer like premium support on it.
Premium support and professional services. If you want to put together one of these things and you don't know how, we are here to help you.
Great. Okay. Anything else?
Happy to be here.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you very much for being here. We'll talk to you again, listeners, soon on Herding Code.
Did you just dear listener?
Dear listeners?
He did dear listeners.
Bleep that out. It'll be great.
This episode brought to you by Telerik.
Damn it. No, it'll say, we'll talk to you again. Beep, listeners. I think it could work.
I think Queen Beatrice will approve.
That's true.
I grew out of my nose last night.
Wait, what?
Come back from that one, MC boy.